In a world of mindless movie cliches, one podcast fights back. Critics are calling it profound, epic, free. Prepare to revisit your video cassette memories of the 1980s and 90s. Behold, it's VHS Rewind.
Arcade players, get ready. The new Atari 5200 Super System is here. With a controller so advanced it plays arcade. Graphics so real it looks arcade. With arcade hits you can't play on any other system. No other home video system can touch it. The new Atari 5200 Super System. It's as good as you are. Maybe even better. Next time.
We'd like to thank you for taking us into your homes. We wish you all a happy holiday.
Hello, you are listening to VHS Rewind. My name is Mark, and right now I am on Skype talking to Tim, and correct me if I butcher your name, just because I have a very difficult last name to pronounce, and you don't, I don't think. It's Lapatino?
Yep, yeah, you nailed it.
Tim Lapatino, who is the author of The Art of Atari, which is just a friggin' cool book, man. I mean, how much... Is this about 5 pounds? 6 pounds?
I think it's 4.2 pounds, I believe.
I don't know if you're a KISS fan. But, you know, KISS released Kistery like 15 years ago or something. Mm-hmm. It's like 9 pounds. It's like this big, huge book. And that's what this reminds me of. And that's what this will be next to on my bookshelf.
Well, that's good company. Definitely. Can't go wrong with KISS.
But you know what? They never had a KISS game, right?
That's
that would
true.
Have been actually pretty awesome.
That would have been awesome.
Like, yeah, I can think of so many. All right. So, yeah, thanks again for, you know, taking the time to, you know, jump on here and talk to me about your book, which, again, it's a hardcover book for one, and it's just, you know, it's really awesome. I noticed there's a deluxe version as well.
That's right.
Which is off my price point, but it's in my Amazon wish list.
Yeah, so, you know, there was two, we really wanted to have something, you know, the regular edition for everybody, but we also wanted to do a deluxe that had something a little extra special for fans.
What's the difference?
So the deluxe edition, the interior of the book is exactly the same, but the box itself, the slipcase, looks like an Atari 2600 box.
Yeah, I noticed that
cover,
right off the...
Right. And then the actual hardcover, the cover itself looks like a 2600 cartridge. It has that same sort of black sort of textured feel to it. It's got the label on the front that looks like the front label.
Right.
And then also included in it is a limited edition art print that I actually commissioned from Cliff Spahn, who was one of the original Atari 2600 artists, which is really cool. So, you know, he was the, and let me just, I'll just dive in right here.
Yeah.
He was basically the guy who sort of set the standard for what Atari 2600 box illustration would look like. So he was a freelancer, and he was the very first freelancer they brought on to, you know, illustrate this stuff. And his art really sort of set the standard for what that art was going to look like. And it evolved later on, but he really was the model for how they would do this art. But it was pretty funny that just almost 40 years later, he was willing to, you know, I reached out to him because we talked quite a bit for the book. You know, we did a profile of Cliff in the actual book. I interviewed him multiple times, but he was game for going back, sort of back in time, and doing a new 2600 styled piece in this art style that he used to do. He doesn't do this anymore, but he kind of came out of the retirement in that way.
That's actually really awesome.
Yeah, to do a piece for this book, which was really awesome. So there's an 8x10 print in the deluxe edition of this new piece of Atari art that he did, that's sort of an homage to not just his art, but also a lot of the other art you know, a lot of the other artists, the work that they did. So that was really fun for me. I mean, it was kind of full circle because he is one of the artists, among others, at Atari who really inspired me and really got me, you know, sort of at a very young age, interested and excited about image making and storytelling through images and really just creativity and design. And here I am, you know, almost four decades later, I'm art directing him for the stories that I'm telling. So
yeah,
it was pretty surreal.
That's actually really incredible. It's funny. I'm flipping through here and I'm just looking at the art, and this is a perfect book to do one of these things where, I don't know if you're a collector of toys or collector of things, mm-hmm. or probably, mm-hmm. I'm going to guess you are, but
yes, you're right.
I've known you all of 100 seconds. I think you are. Like, make past judgment. No, and it's like, this is the perfect book to go, yep, had that. Yep, yo, I remember that. And you really genuinely do. Like, Maze Craze. I don't know why I remember this. I don't know if I actually ever had it, but I know this cover.
Totally.
Night Driver, classic cover. You know, I'm just kind of flipping through Superman, one of the worst games ever on the 2600. I never understood it, but it had a great cover.
Yeah, you know, and that's a funny thing. I mean, that's like the obvious play with this book, right? It's for people to go back and it totally connects them to their memories of those games. Everybody had, you know, their own games that they really loved. You know, what was your jam? You know, we loved, you know, my family, it was Barnstorming, which is one of the worst games ever, but for some reason we just absolutely loved it.
Yeah, now, mine was Carnival. I don't know why.
Nice. You know, we were big Enduro fans, you know, loved Missile Command, loved Space Invaders. But, you know, so that, I mean, that was the obvious thing with this book, is connecting people to their childhoods. And not to denigrate that, because it's totally awesome. You know, it's a huge part of why this book has, you know, has seen some success. But the other part of it was, I really wanted to use that art of Atari to sort of talk to people about creativity, about art and design. You know, a lot of people think about the programmers and the hardware, you know, whether it's an arcade or in home consoles with Atari, because they really were innovators.
Yeah.
But, you know, not a lot of people talk about what did it take to market these games and sort of sell them and, you know, build this Atari identity that's still around even today. So I really wanted to focus on these artists who really never got their due, but also the graphic designers, the industrial designers, the people who, you know, did that work that maybe was a little bit less sexy, but at the same time, it was still super integral to this overall game playing experience, right? Yeah. You know, when you popped in that cartridge, it wasn't just, you know, your paddle playing Super Breakout. You were also that astronaut with that, this huge rainbow brick wall sort of reflected on that, on the faceplate of the astronaut's helmet, you know, and those two things were just, they just tied so strongly together when you were playing those games. I felt like that was a really important part of how you saw yourself and what you were doing on that screen.
See, at a young age for me, it was always the joke with my family and my brothers and everyone, because, you know, you would go and get this Atari cartridge, or really, I mean, it kind of, they started the entire movement for every single cartridge to have this amazing badass cover, and then you pop in the game and you're like, what the hell is this? You know? And obviously, you know, imagination went a longer way when I was a kid. But I remember getting, I don't know what game it was. I really wish I knew what game it was. And I remember being in the car looking at the box, and I'm like, I can't wait to get home. I'm going to play this. It's going to be awesome. And popping in and just being completely disappointed. But at the same time, I think just as much creativity, if not more, went into the box art than the cartridge, which is why, personally, why I held on to the boxes and why I held on to the manuals. Because I just felt as though looking at those pictures brought me almost as much of enjoyment as I got out of a game that maybe I felt wasn't the best game in the world.
Sure, right. And I mean, with Atari games, it was like pure gameplay, right?
Sure.
So, you know, until we hit sort of Pac-Man, you know, there aren't a whole lot of game storylines. So they're, you know, so at Atari, they're trying to create just a little sense of what it is like to play these games in a sort of a emotional connection with, you're playing real sports tennis, or Video Olympics, and just the idea of the energy and the motion of those games, even if it wasn't a one-to-one. I mean, you know this just as well as I do, and I think it's hard for people who were born a lot later, is that this was still state-of-the-art stuff. You know, it was cutting edge.
Yeah, completely.
It wasn't like that. It wasn't like there was another technology to be like, this is so much, you know, Atari 2600 is so lame. You know, I mean, this was bleeding edge. And so in that way, you know, I don't think people weren't necessarily disappointed that the game didn't meet up, you know, it didn't live up to the art, but it really, you know, some games were good, some were not. And some of the, you know, the artwork was more successful at connecting and communicating that energy than maybe some of it was.
Yeah, I remember when the Atari first came home, it was this big box. You're like, what the, you know, what is going on around here? And it's set up and you're thinking to yourself, I have a whole video game system in my living room right now. Like, it doesn't get better than this. And no, and you're absolutely right. You know, it was state-of-the-art. Maybe two other of my friends had an Atari for the period of time that I had it at first. Mm-hmm. I was one of the lucky early adopters that my family jumped into it.
Yeah.
Probably the last time they really jumped into anything too early. Maybe they got into... It was like VHS, I think we got into a little bit late too. And I think partially, this is why I collect a lot of game systems. I have all the Ataris, I have up to the computers. I collect a lot of computers, all the Commodores, and I have a lot of stuff. And my wife is a saint, because before we bought this house, we had an apartment. And that apartment had a third bedroom that was basically, you know, Mark's shit room. Like, it was just so much stuff. And thankfully here I have a little bit of a space where it's a little bit organized. I have no idea what the future holds to this collection, but I know that my 8-year-old son is learning to appreciate it on some level. I don't know fully he's appreciating it, but we're building a game cabinet right now in our basement based on a Raspberry Pi. Cool. And he's really digging the fact that he's going to be able to play Nintendo games. I got him to play Nintendo. If I can get him... And he likes the Atari controller for the 2600. Mm-hmm. So if I can kind of cheat him backwards a little bit and get him to play Adventure or something, I'd be really happy. The key, you know, like, I would really like that. So we'll see. He plays chess. So I want him to play the Atari chess.
Yeah.
Which I remember being a very well... programmed game for me, who is a very poor player.
you know what's funny about the chess thing, you know, and that's one of the little stories that I came across while working on the research for this book. The very first version of the Atari 2600 box had a chess piece on the front of it.
Oh.
Right? And it was just an illustration. It was just something to sort of show, hey, it's about games and people and some specific games. But Atari didn't have a chess game. And the rumor is that a guy in Florida actually sued Atari for false advertising because they did not have a chess game and the system could not play chess.
At first, so, I mean, I do have a chess game for you.
Right, they do, right.
Oh, okay.
This was at first, but it actually spurred them to work on it. One, they changed the box art to remove that piece of art.
Two,
they spent a couple of years working on it, and they even had a couple of the chess, you know, world grandmasters consulting with them about it. And people said, oh, there's no way you can do chess on the 2600, and they figured it out. So they did it, you know, based on this guy's complaint about it. What really just started out as a piece of decorative package design.
That's actually really amazing. It's like you can picture them, like, scrambling. Like, we finally have a successful product, you know, and it's like, we're being sued for what?
Yeah.
Program it!
Yeah, and they did. You know, and it's just funny, though. It's like, there's so many stories like that in looking at the history of video games, and specifically Atari, because it was the Wild West, you know, all the things that we sort of take for granted, whether you're talking about licensing game properties or even the way games are marketed today. It's just really different, and I think one of the most fun things about looking at Atari is it's just so early on in the life of the video game industry. I mean, people said, oh, you know, what about Nintendo? What about Sega Genesis? And I love those systems, and they have, you know, a place in my heart, but at the same time...
It was nearly 10 years later.
Right, there's something really interesting about no one knows where this is going to go, and sort of figuring it out as they went along. And you can see that in Atari. You can see it in the artwork. You can see it in the graphic design. You can obviously see it in the games. But even things like licensing, for example, there's a piece in the book that when I came across it in researching this and talking with different artists, it was the very first piece of Pac-Man art that was done for the 2600. Mm-hmm. And it was, and if you've seen it in the book, it's wild because Pac-Man is not yellow.
I think I just passed Miss Pac-Man.
Yeah, he's actually chromed, and he's running away from multiple monsters. You know, if you recall, in the early versions of the arcade, they were called monsters. They weren't actually called ghosts yet. And these look like these ferocious, angry monsters, and they look a little bit different. The artist took a lot of license, but it's just this wild piece of art. And it actually never got used. I think that management felt like they were too ferocious and it was too scary. But it's really interesting because it illustrates a point about licensing. Today, if you were to license a Pac-Man game or make a Pac-Man game for your video game system, you know, Namco is going to Bandai is going to hand you assets. They say, this is what Pac-Man looks like. This is the typography you use. This is the art you use. It's got to look like this.
Right. Now, you have a graphics background, right? Like design background?
Yeah. So I'm a creative director.
Okay.
So, you know, this is somewhat the world that I live in every day. You know, licensing and the way marketing has evolved, you know, it's really different. So back then, Atari had the freedom to really make a Pac-Man that they saw. You know, there wasn't an established Pac-Man brand, as it were.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So Atari had this freedom to reinvent Pac-Man, which is really, really interesting because, you know, they actually were able to do things that were really different. Their version of Pac-Man looked different than the one that was on the Saturday morning cartoons, mm-hmm. that was different than the one that was on the arcades, that was different than the one that was on licensed, you know, toys and things like that. And that's really interesting, and it's really fun for me to see. But also it's just neat to see them figuring this thing out. And, you know, now it's all, they have systems for it. There's a playbook, and there wasn't a playbook for this stuff back then. And I think that's what's really exciting about it, because you feel like it's the frontier, you know, and they're all still just sort of flying by the seat of their pants.
Now, in the early 2000s, I worked for Scholastic Entertainment, mm-hmm. and we were working on a PlayStation game for the first PlayStation.
Mm-hmm.
And, no, but you're absolutely right when it comes to the licensing things. It's like, it's, you get, you know, you get your style guide, you know, you get your,
yep.
you have to follow the, you know, specific colors, you know, it can do this, but it can't do that, you know, and all that great stuff. And, you know, and that was, you know, over a decade ago. I can only imagine now how much more intense it all is. But, you know, with that, you know, we had the I actually wanted to really steal this. It was the purple PlayStation. Mm-hmm. So it was like the tester's one. Like, it'll play anything you put in it, you know. And mm-hmm. I just remember it sat on my desk for like 6 months, and Sony was not asking for it back. I'm like, I wonder, you know. So one day they were just like, can we get that back? And one of my biggest regrets for not just stealing it. I'm too honest.
Not just running away with it?
Well, I could have just said, I don't know where it is. Somebody wants to order my desk. What do you want me to do? You know, and I'm flipping through here for the hardware and stuff like that. I remember years and years ago, about that same time, around like late 90s, I was just getting into the emulations, like, of different game systems, and mm-hmm. What was it? Stella came out as like a DOS piece of software that emulated the 2600. Yep. But I remember they were talking about a prototype that came out, and I'm looking in here for, I don't know if you know anything about it, but the wireless controller.
Yes, yes.
What do you know about that? Because I remember seeing photos, and now I can't find photos anymore. They could be fake. I'm not really sure.
So there were two wireless controllers for Atari. One was the one that eventually went to market, and it looked like the regular CX model, but had a really, really heavy base, you know, really thick base on the bottom of it.
It was like batteries, right?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, they were battery powered. And it had these really thick, you know, heavy duty antenna.
It was like the walkie-talkie, like 40-foot
right.
whip.
Right, but they worked. But right. But Atari had done an earlier version of those as part of the Atari 2700, which was a console that never made it to market. And I have some info about it in the prototype section. it was a version of the 2600, but it was all wireless. Controllers were wireless. The styling of the console was different. It had really nice, like, recessed LED lit buttons, and it had a sort of space in the back, sort of like the 5200, where you could open up this little, flip up this little chamber, and that's where you stored your controllers. So they actually had used some of those design cues from this product. They ended up making their way into the 5200. But I think the word that I got from some of the creators was that they were struggling with the RF on the remote controllers because it was opening people's garage doors.
Probably remote controls too for TVs.
Right. So the people's garage doors would come open when people were playing these things, and it was hard to differentiate pairing, your two controllers with your console versus your neighbor who might live, 500 feet away. But it's a beautiful console. The industrial design is really amazing. They only made like 25 of them. There was a short production run before an actual run was made.
But it's still forward thinking. It's completely spot on for what would come, 30 years later.
Right. And, I found a lot that Atari did a lot of those things, whether it was working with holograms, with the Atari Cosmos, or, remote controls or things like this. They were too far ahead of the game, and some of those things failed. It didn't look like it would work because the technology didn't catch up yet. So they were towards the end when, they started having a kind of a mass exodus in the mid 80s, where, before that they had a really, really healthy R&D program, a great department, and those guys and girls were really, really coming up with some really interesting stuff.
So what is your favorite system out of these? I guess out of the main three, I'm going to say, like the 2600, 5200, and the 7800.
I mean, for me, it's got to be the 2600 all the way. I mean, the 7800 was a really interesting console. It had some great stuff to it, but the timing was all wrong.
Mine doesn't work anymore, so it's not built unfortunate. Robust. I'll eventually find one that works.
But the 2600, I mean, just the massive library of games, from first party to third party. I mean, there's just so many games. And I think the thing that has kept me really enjoying it over the years is that you see from the beginning of the life cycle of that console from 1976, excuse me, to 1990 when the last official game was made for the console. I mean, just a huge evolution in what people were able to squeeze out of that thing. You see these amazing games. You went from basically, combat and air-sea battle, which are super, super simple games, but really fun, all the way up to things like Pitfall 2 and Rampage and, right. Even attempting Double Dragon and Kung Fu Master on 2600 hardware is just amazing. It's just really cool to see that the console was built so flexibly, and that if you were smart, you could take advantage of that. You see people doing that today, even in the homebrew scene. There's just some amazing stuff being done. And, in this community of people who really want the challenge of trying to write, new software for old hardware.
Right, just really squeeze it into that that small form factor. I also want to clear up, my 7800 is broken, but my 26, I've several 2600s, and none of them are broken. I don't think you can break a 2600. You can break the buttons, but you can always figure a way to get it powered on some level.
Yeah, it's funny. It's just different. They were robust for the most part.
And the wood grain,
I've heard of some people I know have actually run them over with cars, and they still worked.
Well, you can definitely do that with the cartridges. Back in the late 80s, at least here on the East Coast, there was a tremendous... Once the Nintendo was really popular, there was a tremendous influx in, what would you call these? Like wholesale liquidator type of stores, mm-hmm. where you could go in there and you could buy every single Atari game that you wanted for about $2 each. And I remember going there once and my mom was like, I don't know, pick out like 15,
Wow.
And I just remember just thinking, these are all incredible games. And they weren't off-brand, versions of things. They were legitimate you know, Atari approved games.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just really crazy. I just remember getting, what was it? I got the original Pitfall in the original box, and I still have it sealed. But I got two of them just so I can open one. And, you know, stuff like that. And it was just really an amazing time. But that brings you to that documentary where they were dumping so much of this stuff. They didn't know what to do with it because they created so much of it that they were literally burying in the middle of the desert and covering it in concrete, which I just think is such a strange way to do something. It just makes me wonder what was going on in Atari at that time. I mean, you could have sent all that stuff to a shredding company for probably a lot less.
Well, I think they went to Alamogordo because it was cheap, you know, and it was also like there were certain regulations about what they could dump and not dump. And I think also a lot of these places did not have anti-scavenger laws, and that they were really looking for something.
That's true. Yeah.
They were looking for a place where people weren't really supposed to go in there and pull out games that worked.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's really interesting because, you know, you talk about that and, you know, that sort of vision that sort of haunted me throughout researching these, you know, all this stuff is hearing all these near misses. For every time that I would stumble upon artwork, either in the hands of a collector or a former artist or something, there were at least as many stories of saying, oh yeah, I saved all this stuff and then we lost it in a move. Or when they closed this Atari plant, people were just throwing things into the dumpster.
It's like, you know, no!
Right, you know. Feel like Indiana Jones. This belongs in a museum.
And it literally does.
Yes. And, you know, and so every time I was able to save something, even if it was just, you know, even if it was 4x5 film transparencies of artwork, I felt like, you know, I did feel like Indiana Jones. There was times where just, you know, rescuing stuff from oblivion. And I really wanted people to, you know, there's stories to be told here. And I think it really says something about us. It says something about our culture. It says a lot about the video game industry and how it's grown and evolved and changed. So, you know, it gave me nothing but pleasure to capture the stuff that was sitting in, you know, someone's shed in California.
Right.
And, you know, scanning it, cleaning it up, and bringing it back to life as this book that, you know, tens of thousands of people are going to be able to appreciate, enjoy, and study for,
did
you know, hopefully
you
a long
layout?
Time. So I art directed the book, but
okay.
One of my regular collaborators, his name is Jason Adam. He's a designer out on the West Coast in L.A. Mm-hmm. He did the actual, you know, boots on the ground design work of the book.
It's really beautiful. I mean, every single page, it's, you know, I used to work for a lot of newspapers and magazines, but I worked for the Village Voice where we were doing a complete redesign of the entire paper. And, you know, we were always trying to come up with, you know, more, you know, retro, but not so retro where it feels retro. Right. I think you guys really nailed it. I mean, the photos and the scans are all, like, oversized. They're cropped, like, really nice. The paper stock is really great. I don't, like, every page, I want to get another one of these, rip out pages and put them in frames. really, I mean, and I see you have another book coming out soon of just posters.
Yeah, that's right.
That looks amazing.
Yeah, you know, for me, I always wanted to, you know, see these things as large as possible. So, you know, we pushed and pushed as much as it made sense from a budget standpoint with our publisher, Dynamite, to make the book as big as we can make it, you know. And it's a decent size. It's a pretty big book.
I think it's a great size.
You know, and I was really excited about making the art as big as we could. And we really said, you know what? We're going to run as much art as large as possible as it makes sense for this book.
Holy cow, the Dukes of Hazzard art is hilarious. With the Boss Hog back there. Holy cow.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. You know, and I think we really wanted, you know, I really wanted people to see this art and be able to see that level of detail. You know, and we even did some sort of zoom in, you know, on the art with some of these detail pages.
Yeah.
And it was cool because it's really the largest that the art has ever been since it was created, like the original art was actually painted or created, because these things showed up on, you know, 4-inch by 4-inch squares on the actual boxes. So this is the largest that a lot of this art has ever been reproduced.
Yeah, I mean, the price point is actually really good. On Amazon, I think it's going for like $30.
Yeah, I think it's 25 now. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I really think I might just buy one. I mean, you sent us this one, and thank you very much for it. But I might just rip it into shreds and buy another one.
Do it. Well, you know, and that's all. I think that's all on, you know, Dynamite. They really wanted this to be accessible, and it's a great book. You know, they did a really great bang up job with the production, and I was really happy with it.
Yeah.
You know, I've been involved in a lot of book projects, and it was really nice to have a little bit behind this and do some nice things that made a lot of sense for the presentation of the book. But number one, it's like, you know, we wanted to make sure that the art was the hero. And if we did anything else design-wise with the pixel patterns and things like that, we really wanted it to be secondary. We didn't want to try and we didn't want to make this so fancy that it wasn't accessible.
I don't know. It's got a bookmark ribbon. I mean, that's pretty fancy.
It is fancy. But, you know, we didn't want to stick our noses in the air and pretend that this is, you know, this is high art or something, and these should all be white, bright white museum walls. We wanted it to be accessible and wanted to have some fun with it. But at the same time, we didn't want to sort of take away from the art, because the art and the design was really the heroes. So for me, it was really important to do that, but then also have some context. Yeah. You know, I loved being able, you know, we stumbled upon all kinds of photos and things from, you know, documents from back in the day. And I wanted to include as much of that for context as possible, because at the end of the day, for me, this isn't just a nostalgia trip. It's also, hey, you know what, this artwork and this design stands on its own, and it deserves to be taken seriously as, you know, great creative work.
Well, yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's what we tried to do in the book.
Does it stop with Atari, though? Does this kind of open you up to, like, all right, well, what's next, buddy? You know?
Well, I'm definitely interested. You know, for me, this book was a real passion project, you know, because Atari was sort of my original jam. As far as video games go. And I definitely have some real love for the NES, for, you know, for the Sega Genesis.
Well, and some of those other, and all that stuff.
I really don't like the Intellivision. And it's probably those controllers. But, you know, there's also some of that rivalry, that old Atari Intellivision rivalry. So I appreciate that console what it is. But it's never been my favorite, right? You know, it's sort of like, are you a Cubs fan or a Sox fan? Well, I'm an Atari fan. I'm not an television fan.
Right.
And you know, I think there's been a lot of interest in this book, and I think it's opening some new doors for us. So I'll see, you know, what my next projects are. There may be some video game stuff. Nothing I can talk about just yet. But for me, it's really about where creativity and design and pop culture, where those things collide. You know, I'm always interested, you know, I'm a designer, right? And that's the language that I speak. That's my day job. That's how I think about the world. So when I approach this, I didn't just approach it as sort of a, you know, a lifelong Atari fan and a, you know, a gamer. I really approached it as, hey, I'm a designer. How would I look at this? How do I think about the work that's being done here? So that's sort of my lens. And I really like to use these things, whether it's video games or magazines or art, whatever it is, use that as an occasion to talk about design and how it sort of impacts how we do that, how, you know, we live life. I mean, think about the joystick, that one button joystick. Why, you know, I always wondered, why was it like that? Why was it square? Why wasn't it round? Why was there only one button?
Right.
You know, and it was just a total mind blowing experience to talk to the industrial designer who designed that joystick and to say, yeah, you know, the reason it's square, it wasn't designed for the 2600 at all. It was designed for another system that was actually canceled at the same time. It was one of the Atari's plug-and-play consoles, like the Home Pong. This one was called Tank 2, and it was military. And there were little nested spots. These joysticks would fit into these square spots on this thing.
Yeah.
And the joysticks survived. The console didn't, so they just poured them over. That's why they really don't look anything like the 2600.
And they make no sense. You know, it's like, all right, what am I doing with this cable? I guess twist it around the handle.
Right. And you look at the little compass rose on there. That's military. That rubber boot on there, you know, that sits on the top of the joystick. That's what you would have, like, you know.
It does feel military. I mean, it feels like, Mattel definitely, for instance, you know, they still make gun parts. And it's that kind of plastic that they're making, you know, weapon parts from.
Yeah, so I mean, like, that's totally purposeful, but it's just really interesting to hear the provenance and understand the thinking about in the designer's head about why things were the way they were.
Right.
And those insights are really interesting to me. So wherever I can follow those insights, you know, that's where I'm going to go. And those are the stories I like to tell.
Is there anything that kind of didn't make it to the book because maybe you got your hands on it, like after you went to press?
No, you know, surprisingly, there really wasn't anything that we left out.
I mean, you have so much stuff in here. It's crazy. It's really overwhelming.
I mean, there's a lot. And that was, you know, that was curated and captured over the course of almost 6 years. So we were adding things into the book at the last minute. I mean, even like just a couple weeks before we went to final files, we went to the printers. I found a friend of a friend and I had reconnected with, and he said, yeah, I actually have some of the original logo sketches for the Atari logo, the other logos that were presented along with the one that was eventually selected. Mm-hmm. The designer named George Opperman, who designed these, this guy had bought these from the family of George Opperman, who passed away in the mid 80s. Yeah. And I finally was able to connect with this guy, and I said, hey, I'm like 3 weeks out. Can you help me out? And he's like, yeah, sure. And he was, you know, he had files of this and he was able to share it. And we squeezed it into the, you know, the little section about George Opperman. And, you know, there was always stuff like that. You know, there was quite a few games that were not represented in the book yet. And I was connected to the photographer who shot all the artwork for Atari. And I talked to him on the phone. He's like, yeah, I think I have some transparencies. You know, I probably have four or five of them. And I was like, oh, that's great. Because it is really hard to find four or five Atari pieces. Well, you know, he gets back to me 2 weeks later. He's like, oh, yeah, I have more than a few. I have 40. And I just felt like I just found the Ark of the Covenant. You know, it was amazing.
It's like, add a chapter.
Right. Well, you know, and it was just, it filled in all those places that I, you know, needed to have filled in. So there's so many things like that, you know. I relied so much on other people to help and people to contribute. I mean, the amount of people who, you know, shared either part from their collections or from, you know, their own artwork. There was, you know, dozens of people who I, you know, wouldn't have been able to make this book without.
Is there anything you came across where that you were able to either acquire or keep, or like I'm looking at these the family that has like the silver and blue jackets, like the members mm-hmm. only jackets with the Atari patch. Are you wearing that right now?
No, I do have one of those. The silver ones.
Oh, that's and awesome.
But I only wear it. I only wear it when I lose a bet because it is pretty ugly.
Well, you just need a DeLorean or something. or poor, like, yeah, anything from late 70s, early 80s will do well.
Yeah, no, it's funny. And it was fun. Like, it was a good excuse to acquire some of these consoles so that we could photograph them. But, you know, some of the stuff actually came out of another collection that I'm building that's sort of separate from my own personal collection. Because, you know, this book gestated over a long period of time. And there was a good, I would say, a couple of years where I didn't have a publisher yet. I didn't really have an exact plan for how this book was going to get finished or even made at all.
Right.
You know, there was a good chance that it was never going to happen. And so it really got me thinking, okay, all these stories, all this art, what was going to happen to it if there wasn't a book? And what I realized is there were more stories to tell. And it wasn't just Atari. It was also, you know, other video game systems. And again, like I said about the ideas of where design and pop culture kind of intersect, I realized that, you know, there needs to be a museum who's going to tackle these questions. You know, and there are some great museums like the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester. Mm-hmm. A few of my friends, you know, colleagues out there do great work. They have an amazing video game collection, unbelievable library of research and things like that.
They just opened something like that here. It's a Long Island Children's Museum, which is a pretty big deal. And they just put on display just they have an entire arcade, like a retro arcade,
mm-hmm.
where everything's playable, which is pretty cool. You pay like a set fee and you go in there for like 90 minutes and everything is set to play.
That's awesome.
And the other thing they just introduced about a month ago was the home console. And you can play them, which is pretty cool.
That's very cool. I mean, that's what it's about, right?
I mean, I don't know what their collection looks like, but you know, nonetheless, yeah. it's a step in the right direction.
No, totally. And I think this stuff is starting to get taken more seriously. But, you know, even though there are like the museum in Frisco, Texas, you know, the National Video Game Museum, they're really, you know, these different places, they have a very wide and broad way of talking about video games, which is great. But I really want to focus on, you know, the art and the design. So I have a volunteer team. We're starting the first ever Museum of Video Game Art, and we're calling it MOVA. And our goal really is to do this for all of, you know, all classic video games, really connect with, you know, the art and the marketing and the industrial design and the graphic design and tell those stories.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it's been really fun to be able to find. So a lot of the, you know, stuff from this book has either come from other museums or collectors, but also from this growing MOVA collection that we're building. You know, and our eventual goal is to get some of it up on the web and have it really be a research tool for people, but then also have some traveling exhibits that really do unpack these stories in a way that maybe you can't do in a book, right? You know, I mean, we're kicking around at different things, and we're still early days. I mean, it's all volunteers. It's all done as a side project. Eventually, we'd love to kind of make it more professional, but our real goal is to eventually have some traveling exhibits and maybe even a permanent location at some point. But, you know, we're slowly thinking about these different exhibits. We're working on one about the visual evolution of Pac-Man, you know, and why Pac-Man, you know, has been able to morph and change throughout the years, but he's still utterly recognizable. You know, we're talking about, film and video games and how those two sort of impact each other. You think about everything from Tron, you know, which is a movie about video games, and then there's video games based on the video games in the movie, and video games based on the movie, you know, and there's just this snake eating its tail sort of, you know, great thing about the Tron properties. And then you've got other things like, you know, more modern video games and how the films impact the games and vice versa. So we're thinking about some of that, and we're working on it slowly. And that's something that I'd really like to see happen eventually. But
that sounds awesome. That's really. I also think that, you know, as we move forward with all of, I mean, you play modern games, right? Like play, you know, and you know they're stupendous. They're crazy. It's like you can't believe like what you're looking at. But at the same time, you know, Minecraft is one of the top video games out there. Yeah. And we're talking about very simplistic blocks. And you know, that's something that my son, for instance, he sees the charm of the simplicity of Atari and being able to break it down. And that's why I do have hope for the future when it comes to the appreciation of the early aspects of video games.
Yeah.
Even text-based video games. Yeah. I think that a lot of people, you know, they've forgotten that whole world. The pain of taking a cassette tape and loading it into your computer and hoping for the best. So, you know, I do have a hope, though, that there will be at least an appreciation for the simplicity of the graphics and going beyond the graphics. And but what you're saying, I mean, I love the idea of, all right, you're appreciating the game itself, but you're also, the marketing being a completely separate entity, and the actual Atari itself, for instance. I mean, the design choice there is so strange, but it worked, you know, perfect for the living room. You know, the wood grain, just the way it looks like something that belongs on top of a television.
Right. Well, and that was completely the brief. You know, the brief for Atari was, you know what? People didn't know what to make of home video games. They thought, hey, are these going to turn my children into zombies and rot their brains? The idea of this thing should not be scary. Right. This thing should feel like it fits in your living room, and it should look like your stereo equipment, which is why it has that faux wood grain and it has those German metal switches.
And the vents.
Vents.
You know, to this day, I'm like, what are you venting? Like, what is this?
I think there was talk of it having its own internal speakers. And so the very early Heavy Sixers that have those have, you know, that was basically something that was designed but never implemented.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so it sounds to me that it doesn't stop with this book, which is good.
No. I mean, for me, you know, video games are an awesome way to talk about art and design and creativity and talk to people about the, you know, that doesn't sound exciting to a lot of people, but, you know, I can use video games as a window to talk to you or anybody really about design, about creativity and what it takes to make something and craft and the way that whole process works. You know, for me, I'm a film buff. I love listening to commentaries. I'm not a filmmaker. I wouldn't know what to do with a camera.
Right.
You know, but I love listening to filmmakers talk about their craft and sort of, break it apart, break it down for me.
Right, and what this scene means and why you did this or anything like that.
Right, what are those creative choices? And I think that you can do the same thing with design, and video games are an awesome vehicle for that because everyone has played video games, right? And it's a great way to sort of, in a very non-threatening way, talk about, hey, this is what brainstorming is like. This is what prototyping is about. Here's how, rough sketching, or here's what this visual craft is like.
Right.
You know, and those are things that are near and dear to my heart. And, you might find those lessons in a fancy, quote unquote, traditional art museum, but you could also find them in video games.
Yeah. Well, I have to say thank you very much for, coming on, man. I love this book. I really.
Well, thanks.
I'm really going to just order one. I'm in that mode where I'm just ordering a ton of stuff on Amazon anyway, so I don't think my wife's going to really question another charge.
Awesome.
But, Tim, thank you so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate
you
taking the time. And
yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, anytime. And, anytime you want to come on and talk about whatever, we're always, open.
Great. Sounds good.
All right, man. So, yeah, if please keep in touch. And, I'm totally going to follow, your every move.
Sounds
just,
good.
What the hell's wrong with this guy? All right, man. Thank you so much.
Hey, no problem. Thanks. Take care.
Had my Atari for quite a bit. I still have the original combat game that came with it. The TV computer switch has a loose wire, but just jiggle it a little bit and we can still play Dragon Fire. I don't like to brag about my past, but I scored 890,000 points on Laser Blast. Don't let my efforts be in vain. Don't let my efforts be in. Please don't break my Atari or you're gonna be sorry. Please don't break my Atari or you're gonna be sorry. I know you were just 5 points from your high score, but please put down my system now, 'cause I won't take any more. Don't do anything that you'll regret. Don't step on my joystick, 'cause then I won't have a set. My Pac-Man cartridge might not be new, but my mom paid $50 for that way back in 1982. I don't wanna see it get smashed. I don't wanna see it get. Please don't break my Atari or you're gonna be sorry. Please don't break my Atari or you're gonna be sorry. If you break my Atari, then you'll break my heart. You'll break my heart. Please don't break my Atari or you're gonna be sorry. Please don't break my Atari or you're gonna be sorry. Please don't break my Atari or you're gonna be sorry. Sorry, yours revenge is due for Atari. Have you played Atari today?